The following presentation was recorded at a Christian Light Education workshop. More information at clp.org.
Again, good afternoon and welcome to each one of you to this class on teaching memorization. My oldest brother has the ability to read extremely fast and retain pretty much everything that he reads, at least it seems like it. And as a result of many years of doing that, he has the ability to do what I call listen intelligently. You know, Ryan was to start spouting off stuff about being in medical school and what he learned as an RN, I'd probably soon get lost in the dust and I'd be like, huh? You know, I wouldn't even know the words he was using. Well, Sam can generally pick up the words. In fact, my sister was in medical or in nursing school, and Sam is not trained in any medical field, but he was helping my sister financially. And one of the deals was is if she missed a question on her exam, she was supposed to call Sam and let him know what the question was that she missed. And she said very frustratedly one day, says he's never been to medical school, but he can answer all of those questions. Well, one day as my dad and I were observing Sam in one of these intelligent listening sessions, my dad kind of said to me in jest, he says, if I could remember as much as Sam does, I'd be smart too. Our goals as Christian educators is not necessarily just to make smart people. We're after wise people. And wisdom is the combination of two things, the facts and the fear of God combined. And today we're not going to be looking at developing the fear of God. We're simply going to be looking at developing the ability to retain the facts, or be what we might call smart. Since memorization is hard work, I'm going to submit to you six reasons why you should memorize yourself and why you should teach memorization in your school. Starting with the least important, or moving towards the more important, the first reason you should memorize is because you are what you know intellectually. Think of your student that has to keep going to the back of his math book or back to that paper that has all of his math facts on, say 9 times 7 is, say, 63, so he writes 63 on his paper, and then he goes for the next one, 5 times 6 is 30, and you know he writes it on his paper. You are what you know, not what you can access. We live in a time where there is a proliferation of all kinds of electronic devices. My phone is laying over here charging. I was going to hold that up for a prop. But we live in a time where there's this proliferation of electronic devices that give us the ability to access a tremendous amount of information very rapidly. But remember, you are what you know, not what you can access. Intellectually, memorization gives you the ability to understand the present. We have seen those people that have been touched with dementia. A couple years ago, about a year ago actually, I had the opportunity of meeting one of my previous student's grandfather. This gentleman had lived in Los Angeles all of his life, and in his younger days he'd ran a milk route delivering milk to the refrigerators in people's homes. That's how he made his living for the first about 20-something years of married life. Well, that business fell through and he ended up selling it because it was no longer a profitable business. And he took the money he got from that, he retrained himself as a diesel machinist and spent the rest of his working days working as a diesel mechanic on locomotives. When I met the gentleman, he had had Alzheimer's for a number of years. And he was at his son's place, my student's father's place, and he was just antsy and edgy. He's like, who are all these people in my house? And what are they doing here? What do they want? And he kept trying to run us off. So they would take him and take him back to the bedroom, and after a while you'd hear him crashing around in the hall, and he couldn't figure out where the kitchen was. He'd be like, where's the kitchen? Where's my wife? You know, and just, he was lost. He couldn't understand the present because he could no longer recall those facts from his memory. Then there are the behavioral benefits of memorization. Not only does memorization help us understand the present, it gives us the ability or causes us to define the present. Think of a professional. You know, you think of a doctor in an emergency room. You bring in a person or a patient that is hurt. If I gave each one of you enough time, you could probably do some research and figure out what needs to be done to this patient. But we don't have the ability to ice down the patient and put him on hold for 2 or 3 weeks until we figure out what needs to be done. What you're depending on is a man who understands the present, and as a result of his training has the ability to make decisions in the present that define what happens in the future and define the present. So memorization gives you the ability to define the present. The more you know, the better you will be able to define your present. It is also a discipline, and this is another behavioral benefit. Memorization demands long, hard, intensive practice, and there are absolutely no shortcuts. If you've had Bible memory in your classroom, you know the students come up and they either know their Bible memory or they don't know their Bible memory. There's no shortcuts. They can't take it home and cheat on it and bring it back to school the next morning. Now, I wish they could sometimes, but you know, go home and cheat on their flashcards and know their flashcards when they came to school the next morning. It'd be awful nice. Here's a story from my years of teaching experience. In the first years of teaching, the very first year I taught, I received two students, or excuse me, I received more than two students, but one student in particular I'd like to talk about. I received him, and he had squeaked out of fourth grade into fifth grade, and that's the level I was, my starting level. And the school had a policy, I think it was 75% was mandatory fail. If their average was 75% or lower, they'd mandatory fail. He had like a 75.2 or 75.1 or something like that. He just snuck by the skin of his teeth. And I gave them a stiff memory program. I insisted on 5 new verses a week, and it was tough for him. And he struggled. And his parents, even though they were supportive at times, they did raise questions about the size of this memory load. And honestly, I wasn't sure whether I wasn't pushing him a little bit too hard at times myself. But we continued on all through that year. And as many poor students are, there were other problems. The second year he came back to school, well, that year he squeaked by again by the skin of his teeth. It was still a 75.2 or 3 or something like that. Very low grade. They wanted him to move on. The next year he came back, and the thing that I noticed had changed is all of a sudden he was determined to get his Bible memory done and try to get a good grade on it. This went on for several weeks. And one day, I was walking through the playground. This was several weeks or maybe even a few months into the school year, and I heard him saying to his classmate, he says, you know, I've been trying to get 100 on my Bible memory, but he says it goes up, 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 and then it falls down. He says, and I just can't quite make 100. And I remember making a mental note of that. The next time he comes and he gets even close to 100, he's getting 100 because he's working for it and he's doing his best. And I'll never forget the day I gave him 100. He was ecstatic, to say the least. He was happy. I think it was one of the first times he'd ever gotten 100 in all of his school years, to be honest. But you know what happened? The discipline it took for him to get to that point and the fire of success, as those two things came together, it flowed over into his other work. When he graduated from school 2 years later, he was an A+ student. And what had happened is, I had, looking back, it wasn't as clear to me then, but what had happened is that memory was a discipline that changed his behavior. That's one reason I think you should memorize. Now, your most important reasons for memorization is memorization spiritually is a sin deterrent. In Psalms chapter 119, verse 11, it says, Thy word have I hid in my heart that I might not sin against thee. I will hide God's word in my heart to deter the temptations to sin. If you look at Christ's answer to the tempter when he was in the wilderness for 40 days and he was being tempted, it is recorded in Matthew chapter 4 as he said to the tempter, "It is written, it is written, it is written." And I don't believe he was shuffling around in his pocket pulling out some piece of paper, or he didn't have testaments then, maybe, you know, the idea of a testament, you know, shuffling through it and thought, "Well, here it says it's written, therefore I'm not going to do it." It was in his head. Memorization spiritually gives us a sin deterrent. It also is the fruit of obedience. In 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, it says, "Sanctify the Lord God in your heart, and be ready always to give an answer of the reason of the hope that lieth within you with meekness and fear." How are you going to always be ready if it isn't something that you have readily accessible in your memory? Summarizing this section on why to memorize, I would say memorize because it gives you the ability to make better use of the opportunities and resources around you and that God has blessed us with. What to memorize? First, the story. There is a young man in our community that comes from a unreligious or non-religious home. They're good citizens, but they're non-religious. They don't do it. They have no time for church. They don't take time for it. And he was telling me a few years ago why he had given up rock, hard rock music. He said one of his favorite bands had a line of lyrics in one of his favorite songs that went something like this: "Kill the cop, stab the judge," and proceeded with some other profanities and horrible things. And he knew he wouldn't ever do such a thing, but one day, unbeknownst to him, as he was traveling down the road, taillight on his car was out, and the state trooper was going to pull him over, and he said, "I looked in the mirror," and he said, "there were the blue lights," and he said, "the first thing that went through my mind was kill the cop, stab the judge." And he had the wherewithal to recognize that what he was drilling into his mind by listening to that music over and over and over again was popping out in ways he didn't want it to pop out. Therefore, he gave up his music. I submit to you this afternoon that if you are going to spend all the time and effort of drilling in something deep, which is what you'll do when you memorize, drill in the words of life, so that when something does pop out, it'll be fruits of life rather than fruits of death. Well, Lyndon would be delighted. Moving on, you will notice on your paper I have two sections under how to memorize: processing and optimizing. Well, actually three sections, and retention, transmission, and retention. I'm going to try to condense all three of these down. I've been whittling and tweaking with these, and this is where you get to be my guinea pigs. Processing, optimizing, and tips. We're going to look at them briefly in that order. Processing. What happens when you receive a sensation? The sensation is some form of well, let me back up. Before we talk about the sensation, you have these nerves. Your nerves are made up of cells that are called neurons. And on one end of the neuron, you have these little fibers that they call dendrite. On the other end of the neuron, you have tails that are called axons. Between two of these neurons, or these two nerve cells, there's a gap between the axons and the dendrites. And for information to travel from one of these cells to the next cell, there must be a chemical reaction that takes place here that is called a synapse. That's that word right there. And when the synapse takes place, the information moves to this neuron, and then it gets to here, it stops, synapse takes place, and it moves to the next cell, and the next cell, and the next cell, and so on. The important thing you need to recognize is where synapse takes place, it leaves like a small print. Think of it like walking through the grass. You walk there, it might not be much of a print left. You know, the grass is crunched down a little bit after you're gone, but there's still a slight print. And where that path forms is where there is a memory. If you here's just a brief animation. You have information, it travels through the cell, synapse takes place, and it moves on to the next cell. Moving on, there's three things you need to know, or three things that happen to produce long-term memories. Long-term memories are produced as a result of frequency, duration, or intensity. Frequency deals with the number of repetitions. If I stood here and told Matthew to say my name 100 times, I bet a week from now you could ask him what he did this afternoon and he could tell you exactly what he did. That would be frequency. Doing it over and over and over again within a short period of time or a great number of repetitions. Duration is different. It's the number of times you do it over a period of time. So he wants, let's say he wanted to remember my name. He'd say it several times to himself today, and then tomorrow he'd say it a time or two to himself, and the next day he'd say it a time or two to himself. And he'd skip a couple days, and then, oh yeah, I want to remember his name. Yeah, I remember his name. He'd say it another few times, and then a month from now he'd say it again. That's duration. Intensity deals with the power of sensation. And the sensation is so strong that you tend to remember it. Now, all of us have been involved in an accident at some time in our life. It didn't last for but just a split second or a few seconds at the most. But we will never forget it, and that's due to the intensity of the situation. It's not that we kept repeating it over and over and over again that we remember it, but because of the intensity of it. How does this apply as a teacher? Frequency is found in, you know, you teach the concept and then you do five problems that have a very similar concept. That's frequency. The reviews are intensity and, excuse me, are duration. And intensity is primarily up to you. You can increase intensity by making it important. It's important for you to know this for this reason. You can also increase intensity by offering a reward or a threat. You know, if I tell you at the end of the week, if everybody does well, we're going to have ice cream. Well, they all want to do well, so the intensity of that makes them all try to do better. Or you can threaten them. Another 70, we're going to see you in the office, you know, and you don't want that to happen. Sorry, Matthew, you're up here, right here, where I can wave my finger at you. I don't want to scare these girls off, because then we wouldn't have their wisdom at the end of this topic. But anyhow, you get, does that make sense? And as you can increase all three of those as a teacher, you will improve the ability for them to simply retain information. Maybe not rote memorization, but increase it, give them the ability to retain the information you want to. There are three types of memory in your that they speak of when they observe how your mind works. You have sensory memory, short-term memory, and long-term memory. And I'm simply going to try to point out to you a few things about these different memories that you will want to know. Your short-term or your sensory memory handles visuals and audio differently. And as you can combine the two of them, as you can see this and hear my voice, you're more likely to retain the information than if I did just one or the other. In sensory memory is where you get your initial quality check. And basically what's happening is sensory memory is saying, is this important? And importance is usually dictated by where your attention is focused. If you're focused on listening to me, stop and listen for a moment. Do you hear the ceiling fans now? Now, were you noticing those ceiling fans a half a minute ago? Probably not, because your attention wasn't focused there. So as a teacher, make sure, am I preaching to the choir here when I say this, make sure they're paying attention to you. Otherwise, they aren't going to retain what you're saying. And I appreciated what I saw a few years ago at a teacher's institute. We were at this teacher's institute, and all of us were teachers now, you know. We're all grown up. We're supposed to know better than this. But we were sitting in this room, and there were big windows on the one side of the room, and right outside the window was this wheat field. Well, we were having this topic, and I don't remember what. But a combine comes by, harvesting wheat. And we all start to look out the window. And the presenter did something that I have used ever since. He stopped. He says, get up and go look at the combine. We all got up and we went and looked at the combine. I mean, adult guys have grown up around combines, going and looking at a combine in a wheat field like you'd never seen it before. After a minute or two, like, okay, let's proceed. And he backed up just a little bit and started going again. Next time the combine came around, I don't think one of us looked out the window. And I found that works in the classroom. So someone goes, round, goes by during class. Yeah, maybe they should have the discipline not to look out the window, but they probably are going to. You know, if I'd gotten one of these people here in the back to come in here with a pop gun or a blank or something like that, and right now they pulled that off, I bet all of your heads would turn back there to see what was going on, even though you know you shouldn't, right? Attention dictates retention. So make sure you have their attention. Tell them stories and other things like that to gain their attention. In short-term memory, things do not last very long in your short-term memory. It's anywhere between 10 seconds and a minute, depending on the sensation and there's a slight amount of rehearsal. The thing I'd like you to know about short-term memory is they have what they call the primary recency effect. Has someone ever given you a list and you can remember the first one or two things and the last one or two things and you can't remember what's in the middle? And that is a result of what they call the primary recency effect. Because you've had a little bit of time to rehearse the first ones and your mind was fairly empty when they started giving you this list, you can retain it. And the last one you can remember because it was the most recent one. As teachers, to get things past the primary recency effect, you can use different things. You can use jingles. When I was teaching English, I had some students who were having a hard time remembering the difference between common pronouns and neuter pronouns. And one evening, just playing with it, just kind of fooling around with it, I suddenly discovered a pattern and gave them this jingle. Masculine, male, feminine, female, neuter, neither, common, either. Gave it to them the next day, and they said it a couple of times, and they didn't have any more problems with it because suddenly they had a way to remember it. That was a jingle. You have your acronyms. A doctor was telling me that one acronym he uses very regularly is SOAP. If you come walking in to see him, the first one is subjective, what you say. So you come in and you say, I think I've got purple eyes and green hair. Patient says he has purple eyes and green hair. Then you have O, objective, what I see. He's got brown hair and brown eyes. A, assessment. Patient's crazy. P, procedures, admit to the loony house, you know. But that, and he says he uses that over and over and over. That's a very apparently a common one in the medical field. So, subjective, objective, assessments, procedures. And that gives them the ability to remember and gives them kind of like a checklist. I was hoping Ryan would be here. He was giving me a list of some of those that he's learned since he's been in medical school. But that type of thing. Acronyms, jingles, mnemonics, and other things like that. Just gives them the ability to get them past this primary recency effect. Helps them remember the middle things. There's another thing that takes place in short-term memory. It's what they call the formation of a chunk of information. And a chunk is produced where there is closure, and closure is the result of validity. You all know good and well by now that I've got a weird name, Uwe Steinen. A few years ago, I had the opportunity to work in a new conference where there were hardly any people that knew me. So I'm sitting back there in the sound booth working stuff, and you know, the conference would dismiss, and people would come trickling back. They're wondering about this tall guy that they had never seen before, and you know, they'd come back and they'd start making small talk, and they'd say, so what's your name? I'd be like, Uwe Steinen. And immediately, you can almost see this like flash, and it's like, Levi? Like, no. Or they'd say, what was that again? And what is happening there is they're looking for a chunk of information that is valid, makes sense. And since they were not getting a valid chunk of information, short-term memory was trying to throw it out. It doesn't make sense, so not, don't keep it. And what I have found helps with that is simply to give them another chunk of information before it. My name is different, or it's German, rude, or something like that. So that when I say Uwe Steinman, it doesn't ping it as invalid, and it works. And they don't get this flash of, oops, what was that again? And the same thing happens in the classroom. What you want to do is you want to give them small chunks of information that make sense. You can make it make sense by having logical order. You can make it make sense by using some form of imagery, a picture, a tree. So, you've seen the little man that they use. Heading, greeting, body, closing, and signature, to remember the parts of a letter. You're doing something to produce chunks of information, and then you try to take the smaller chunks and make larger chunks out of them, like, what's your name? Uwe Moore Steinman. So you're thinking first, last, and middle. All three of those make one major chunk of information. Validity, make it valid to produce closure, and then it's ready to move it on into long-term memory. The thing you need to remember about stuff arriving in long-term memory is that it takes rehearsal, except in those weird cases like where you have an accident and you hurt yourself and you remember it forever and never after. It takes rehearsal. Cause them to somehow repeat the information. So you tell them, you have them paraphrase it back to you. And then you have them do the lesson. And then the next day, you do a review. You're doing rehearsal, 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 and that's what's taking place. And you must continue to use it or you will lose it. Now, I know it seems like there's some of those people that they don't rehearse it very long and they have it for the rest of their life, but the majority of us, we've got to keep using it. You've got to use their name. You've got to think of the situation or whatever it is over and over again, or you'll lose it. In summary, remember these three points. Attention dictates retention. Validity produces closure, and you must use it or lose it. Those are the three important points from the first three sections, or all three sections under how to memorize. Moving into tips. Now, as we move into tips, I would like you to be thinking of things that you have found work for you. I'm telling you what I have found work for me and what's helped some of my students over the years, but I don't by any means profess to be an authority or the end of the matter on the situation. Look at the fruit. Help your students recognize that if they know something, even though it's hard to learn it right now, it will be beneficial to them in the future. Going back to the simple illustration of math facts, if you know your math facts, you will be able to do your long multiplication faster, therefore you'll be able to go out at recess time. So do the hard work of learning your math facts today so you can go out at recess tomorrow. Look at the fruit. Leverage the information. Now what I mean by leverage the information is you as a teacher need to take it upon you to make the information easier to remember. Give it some form of structure. Make it logically organized information. When you assign a Bible memory passage, use the Bible memory passage for devotions for several mornings so that it's not just they're just remembering this whole list, a long list of words, but they actually understand the story or the point of the passage, and as they go through, they have some form of a logical structure to follow. Another thing you can do to leverage the information is produce associations. When I was flying in for this speaking tour, I flew into Virginia, and as we flew from California to Virginia, I had a plane change in Dallas, Texas. I got off of the plane. It was going to be a couple hours between flights. I was hungry. It was about lunchtime. So I went and got myself a sandwich. The waiter's name was Preston. Now you see, the significance of that is I have a nephew named Preston, and that's why I can remember what his name is. So when he said Preston, I was like Zeb's oldest son. And I can remember his name very easily because I associated it with something I already knew. Another part of association is when you simply have the students repeat it back to you in their own words, paraphrase it for you. They are making an association in their brain to what they know as they state it back to you. A third way of leveraging the information is using what they call imagery. I don't know if you all have heard of what they call the Memory Olympics, but every so many years they have these Olympics or these contests where the contestants compete with each other at speed and accuracy of memorization. Here's two of the contests that they do, not by any means all of the contests. Each of the participants or contestants receives a pack of shuffled cards, a deck of shuffled cards. Then the judges or the starter says start, and they start going through that deck of cards, remembering the order that that deck was in. Once they get through that deck of cards, they hit a timer and flip the deck of cards over and hit a timer. And 4 minutes later, a judge comes by and they tell them the sequence that those cards were in. And they do it amazingly fast. Another thing that they do is they have a paper, has pictures of people on it, faces, and under each of the faces there's a name. And they get, I think it's 2 minutes to look at this sheet of paper. And then the paper is taken away, and so many minutes later they bring back another sheet of paper with the same faces on it, but the faces are shuffled and they have to write the names in. And it's amazing what some of these folks can do. And because it seems like they have this superpower memory, what they have started doing is they've studied these people. How do you do it? And the thing that keeps coming up over and over again is they use some form of an image. So you have the deck of cards. The king did this with the queen. You see what we're doing? We're making a story. And this story, they make this story up, and it gives them like an image of the king going somewhere with the queen to do, you know, such and so. So when the judge comes back, the contestant just replays the story in his head as the judge checks the cards. Or, you know, with the pictures, you know, Bobby has a big nose. Stuff like that, you know, so Bobby has a big nose, you know, and Sally has something else. I don't know what the story would be they would make up with that, but they make a story so there's imagery in their head. Make images in your student's head, in your head, and even if it isn't, really doesn't make a lot of sense, it will still help you remember it if there's some form of imagery there. Another tip that I have is titled Level the Labor. Before I tell you about leveling the labor, I'm going to tell you about the way I have taught Bible memory. And I learned this way of teaching Bible memory from the teacher that I had during the last 4 years of my formal schooling. In fifth grade, I had Brother Daniel Hurst for my teacher, and his policy was for your grade level, you learn that many new verses a week. So since I was in fifth grade, I learned 5 new verses a week. When I got to sixth grade, I had to learn 6 new verses a week. Seventh grade, 7 new verses a week, and so on. At first, it was a job. Because what we did is you'd learn your new verses this week, and then you'd say them next week and the following week, along with whatever new verses you'd been learning. So we were saying about 15 verses a week. Got to sixth grade, it was a little easier. Seventh grade, some of us started to compete. Because we didn't have to learn just 6. We could learn 7, we could learn 8 if we wanted to. But whatever new verses you learned this week, you had to say for the next 2 weeks, and any new verses you learned the following week were added to it. That you couldn't learn 8 this week and 3 next week. You had to learn at least 5 new verses or 6 new verses a week. When I graduated 8th grade, there were several of us that were neck and neck for being ahead at the end of the year. And in our last 6-week marking period, we learned Hebrews 10, 11, 12, and 13. On an average, our class did 17 and a quarter or 17 and a half verses per student, new verses per student per week, which means that we were saying over 40 verses apiece every week when we went up to say Bible memory. It worked. So when I started teaching school, I used the same principle, except I didn't do the one verse per year. I just gave them a flat line of 5 verses per week. But the incentive that I gave them was that when you did this section of verses, you're done for the year. When you're finished, you're done. And I would usually give them like around 200 verses. You know, 36 times 5 is 180. So I'd give them, 190 to 200 verses where it'd come out in an even chapter. There's a few more verses than if they did just their bare minimum a week. But when they were finished, they were done. And the phenomenon that I saw happen every time I started that in Monticello, taught there for 2 years, and then ended up teaching in California. Every time I started in a new school, the first year, a few would get done usually in the end of the fifth marking period, the beginning of the sixth marking period. And the rest would catch on. You mean he doesn't have to say more Bible memory this year? I'm like, yeah, that's what I said. When he's finished, he's done. Wow. And boy, they'd start trying to get finished before the end of the year. The second year you come back, watch out. About half of your students will be done by Christmas. I've had several of them be done before Thanksgiving. They want to get it over with. Now, here's the thing that I found helped my students as much as anything. This is where I get leveled the labor from. It's one thing I learned doing Bible memory. When I used to do it, I would start out, and I'd start out, we're going to say, with a new chapter, I'd memorize verse 1, and then I'd memorize verse 2, and then I'd say verses 1 and 2. And then I'd memorize verse 3, and say verses 1, 2, and 3. And then I'd memorize verse 4, say verses 1, 2, 3, and 4. Now, do you see what's happening? Verse 1 is getting repeated a whole lot more times than the subsequent verses. So what would happen is I might memorize 10 verses or 5 verses, and I could say the first one's fairly well, but as I got towards the end, it got harder and harder and harder. What I learned I needed to do, it both reduced the time it took to memorize stuff and gave me a more level dictation of it when I was saying it, was memorize 1, memorize 2, memorize 3, memorize 4, memorize 5, memorize 6. And then I would go back and do, say, 1 and 2 until I could get it. And then say 3 and 4 until I could get it. And then do 5 and 6 until I can get it. You see how we're leveling the amount of attention we place on each verse. And then I go back and say it in groups of 3. And if it was in the later years, we'd keep going up, groups of 4, groups of 5, groups of 6, and so on, until I was saying the whole passage. Level the labor. You see what's happening? Does that make sense? Any questions or points up to this point?
Can you still say Hebrews 11:12 from memory?
Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. I can't quite say it all from memory, but this is what I found happened. I'd had another teacher in my lower grades that gave us a small memory passage and we said it over and over and over again. I didn't retain those passages any better than I did the ones I went over very fast. The blessing that I found in doing it the way it was done to me is it gave me the ability to get a broad view of the scriptures. I've memorized most of the New Testament at least once. And it's not uncommon. I can hear somebody start saying a verse, and I might not be able to say that's Ephesians chapter 3, verse 14, but I'll tell you that's in the middle of Ephesians somewhere. And if somebody presents an idea, I might be able to quote the verse exactly to you, but I can say there's a thought of a verse in Galatians chapter 2 that deals with that. And I can go find it rather rapidly. So that's another reason I've used that. And as they said it, I didn't always demand exact dictation as long as they didn't change the meaning of the verse. So if they got is instead of are or something like that, I often let it slide. Any other questions? That's a good question. This is not a magic bullet, friends. So this is some stuff that research is showing helps with improving retention of information. Looking at lifestyle, there's several things that tend to rise in what they call clusters. An undisciplined person will generally not eat as well, they'll have worse sleep habits, and they won't exercise as much. They also don't remember as well. Now, which one is the chicken and which one is the egg, they really don't know, but they kind of see these things rise together. Where you have a disciplined person, you'll tend to have better eating habits, you'll have better sleeping habits, they'll tend to be more fit, and they tend to do better as they work with retaining information. Here's some tips on diet and eating. They have found that a 35% reduction in calories, presuming you don't mess with the nutritional values or the nutritional ratios, over the long term produces an approximate 35% increase in IQ. So what that means is next time you sit down to eat, load your plate and then push a third of the food back off of the plate. And over about 20 years or 30-year span, you'll become approximately a third again smarter than you are today versus a person who doesn't do that. They also say reduce high saturating fats and empty calories. Highly saturated fats are fats that you tend to find in your red meats, more of them in your red meats. So reductions of red meats and replacements with white meats tend to help with that. They say also to avoid trans fats. Trans fats are your hydrogenated oils and other things that have been hydrogenated to solidify them. Let's see here. Do you all know what the Mediterranean diet is? It is a diet that's high in like olive oil, lots of vegetables, legumes, nuts, whole grains. It's light on meat, especially on red meat. They find that to be one of the better diets if you're really after optimizing your brain. Eat fish. I don't know if y'all like sardines or not, but sardines are one of the fish that are good. Oily fish has been found to help because it has an omega-3 unsaturated fatty acid that is important for developing neurons. Here's one I don't know what to do with. I don't recommend it. I simply present it to you because I think you're old enough to behave yourselves and not do it. But they say a very, very moderate amount of alcohol, such as maybe almost one shot a day or one drink a day, has been found to aid in improving memory. Now, I'm not promoting that. Please understand that. I'm just presenting to you what they have found. I think if you do the rest of them, you can skip the alcohol and you'll still come out ahead because alcohol brings with it a whole bunch of other stuff that you don't want to deal with. Sleeping. Sleeping is actually a very important part of the process of solidifying information in your mind. There's two things that happen when you sleep. One is what they call solidification, and the other one is what they call enhancement. So some solidification takes place as you're awake. It's kind of like it's starting to compact this information into a smaller, more compact, or more usable piece of information. And solidification can get messed up by learning too much new stuff in one day. It's like you can get so much new stuff and that's all it can hold. You've got to have some sleep. You've got to have some downtime for for your brain to process it. And then when you go to sleep, they have what they call the offline effect or the enhancement effect. And this is part of where your dreams come from, they believe. And what happens during that time is when you're asleep, your brain is not doing nothing. It is actually kind of like going through the files and taking what it's learned today and seeing how it matches up with other stuff. So that's why it puts some weird stuff together and you come up with these really weird dreams. Now, as it does that, what it is doing is it's kind of like it's a further compacting of the information and further enhancing of that path or the synapse in the neural system. So make sure you get your sleep. Most people need around 8 hours of sleep. And a 45-minute nap in the middle of the day greatly enhances your ability to retain new information and retrieve what has already been stored away in the back. Interesting point that I gathered as I was studying about this is that sleep deprivation has very similar effects to alcohol intoxication. I don't know if you all have ever pushed yourselves to the extent that you're exhausted. I'm talking 40, 50, 60, 70-hour work days. But when you get to the end of a 70-hour work day, you stagger like a drunk and you trip into cracks on the sidewalk. You start to hallucinate. I've experienced some of that. It's it's, I don't see why a person would drink to arrive at a state like that. But anyway, you lose your ability to retain information, to gain information, and to retrieve information and use it for good judgment. So beware of sleep deprivation. Exercise yourself physically and mentally. And the cardinal rule of public speaking is not quitting on time. So therefore, you are dismissed. If you stay here, I'll give you a couple more thoughts. I'm getting ahead of myself. I find this passage in Psalms 119 interesting. You start out the passage, it's like the man is saying, you know, it's really good to be undefiled. You know, it's really good to walk in the ways of the Lord. It's really good if you keep His testimonies, and it's really good if you seek after Him with your whole heart. And those that do it, you know, they aren't involved in iniquity. They do what is right. And you've commanded us to keep His precepts, and He's commanded us to do this. And it's then in verse 5, he's like, I wish I was like that. And then in verse 6, he goes on talking about why he wishes he was like that. And in verse 7, he talks about why he wishes he was like that. And then in verse 9, it's like the light comes on. He can do it. It's by taking heed to God's word. And that's what we want our students to do. We want them to have that ingrained into them so that they can experience the blessings of verses 1 through 5. In conclusion, know it. There's no substitute for simply knowing it, especially the Word of God. May God bless you. You're dismissed again since you didn't leave.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.